This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Thank you for tuning in. The guy who clicked the wrong choice on a civil emergency alert drop-down menu has been reassigned. Hawaii's governor is promising changes after people spent 38 minutes on Saturday expecting a ballistic missile strike due to said error. KUOW reporter Ann Dornfeld happened to be vacationing in Hawaii with her family. Ann, good to talk with you.
Happy to still be here.
What happened? Will you tell us the false missile alert story?
Sure. We had just arrived to Oahu on Friday night, and Saturday morning woke up bright and early with our three-year-old and went to breakfast, and we had just placed our orders when everyone in the restaurant had their phone start buzzing frantically and looked down to see not, you know, some kind of missing child warning like you normally see or some other kind of alert, but an alert saying that there was an incoming ballistic missile to Hawaii and that this was not a drill.
And you got the alert too, even though you're a tourist. This is just a location-based. If you've got a phone, you have an alert.
That's my understanding, yeah. Everyone's phone was buzzing. And then the waitress came out and said that this was real. This is not a drill. We were welcome to stay there or to find shelter.
How were people reacting?
Well, I mean, people just seemed kind of shocked and stunned. You didn't see anyone, you know, screaming or running or anything, just people kind of murmuring about, you know, what they were going to do. And I didn't pay attention to what the other patrons did. We just decided to beat a hasty retreat.
Really? Because I would be listening to the locals. Where are they going?
That would probably be a wise tactic. But I think that, you know, probably a lot of people would just head home, right? I mean, that's where you're, you know, you feel most safe probably. Mm. But, you know, I just don't think there are a whole lot of really available bunkers these days, no matter where you are in this country. So, you know, that would have been a nice place to head. But we called 911 to see, you know, what was being recommended or if this was real. And there was every indication that it was real.
Did you get through on 911?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Okay, so then what did you do?
I called our families and asked for, you know, our Cold War era parents. We figured we'd have some good advice about where to go if there was a nuclear attack. They just said, you know, find a concrete structure with as many walls between you and the world as possible. But we're in a pretty sleepy little beach community here, and buildings are mostly made of wood, and the only thing that we had seen that might be concrete on the drive-in to the restaurant in the morning was a Whole Foods. So we decided to try to find the Whole Foods. But meanwhile, one of us is driving. The other one is trying to figure out, you know, kind of what's the best strategy. Do we try to contact emergency officials? Do we Google what to do in a nuclear attack? Do we try to, you know, map the Whole Foods? Do we call our families and tell them we love them if this is the last conversation we ever have with them?
And were you working together well, or were you fighting? What was that dynamic?
We were working together really well and keeping our cool, which is really good. And reminding each other to keep our voices down for the innocent ears in the back seat. Our three-year-old was meanwhile chirping out questions like, "Will we go to the beach today? Am I going to take off my shoes? Why am I going to take off my shoes on the beach?" And so cheerfully answering him, "Well, darling, the sand feels really nice between your toes." And, you know, well, we're thinking there's never going to be a trip to the beach, and you will never feel sand between your toes, which is pretty grim, pretty grim.
Yeah. How freaked out were your parents?
You know, I think that they kept their cool as best they could. And of course, they started, you know, calling and Googling right away. My mother called KUOW to find out if KUOW knew anything. But it was Saturday and no one answered the phone. And
sorry.
Yeah, no one could find anything, you know, about this online, which was really weird, considering the entire state of Hawaii was in a state of panic.
So you're in your car, you're talking about beaches, you're driving around, you're looking for a Whole Foods. How are people reacting around you in Hawaii?
It seemed pretty calm. We were getting irritated with how slowly the car in front of us was driving. You know, you're thinking like, well, you don't want this to be some, you know, anarchic sort of situation where you're just blowing through stoplights to get someplace safe. But at the same time, you really are in a hurry to get to a safe location and wondering, how many minutes does it take for a missile to hit Hawaii from North Korea?
Yeah,
I have no idea. 4 minutes? 40 minutes? You know, like, are we stupid for still being on the road right now? Should we just run into someone's carport? And there was a guy who leaned out his car window as he was driving past us and yelled, "Goodbye, everybody," which kind of enraged me. But
was that supposed to be a joke?
Yeah, I think he was trying to make his last hurrah was being funny. I don't know. Yeah.
That guy.
I wasn't amused. But yeah, it was. This is like a very sleepy beach community, and it stayed a sleepy beach community. There's no one running or speeding or anything like that. It was just a strange, calm sameness.
And how long was it before you found out that this was a mistake, and how did you find out?
It was 20 long minutes. Long minutes or short minutes, I guess, depending on how you look at it. Mm. How I found out about it is my husband saw a tweet from Representative Tulsi Gabbard saying that this was a false alarm.
This is a Hawaii member of Congress?
Yes, saying that this is a false alarm. And he had some questions about that because of some other kind of stances she's taken regarding Putin and Russian threat and Trump. And so he was questioning it, whether to believe it.
This is how news reporters think. Wait a minute. Let's analyze this person's politics. I get that.
And then my husband's mother called and said that she had been in touch with the Hawaii State Police and that they confirmed that it was a false alarm. And at that point, it hadn't even sunk in that this was, you know, a real threat. And now it had to sink in that this was a false alarm and our heads were kind of spinning. But it was a long time before they actually sent out a correction to the emergency alert to our phones. It was another 18 minutes. So we're talking 38 minutes from the initial alert to the correction on our phones, which was pretty ridiculous.
What was that like to go from being in utter existential panic to suddenly being back on your island vacation paradise?
Well, I mean, I think the good news is that what you need after an existential panic is a vacation in an island paradise. So
Right. We
embraced the idea of returning to the restaurant and being really glad that our three-year-old and our unborn child had no idea of what we had just been through. Hmm. And thinking then about all the kids who did know what was going on during this and feeling horrible for all those families who, you know, had this existential crisis in their family home on a Saturday morning and how traumatic that would be for everybody.
I will have that kimchi hash and I'll take one of your breakfast cocktails as well.
Yeah, and I missed out on that opportunity being pregnant, but yeah, my husband that night ordered a $40 glass of Pappy Van Winkle at the restaurant we were at because, you know, all of a sudden we had a different approach to spending now that we had tasted our untimely demise.
Okay, so what did you take away? What was the lesson for you from all of this, Anne?
Well, in reading the news accounts of how Hawaiians dealt with this, I felt like they had a lot better idea of what to do in case of a nuclear attack, because for the past few months, I understand, the state of Hawaii has really been doing a lot of emergency drills and nuclear preparedness, educational missions to let people know what to do, because after Guam, Hawaii is supposed to be the likeliest site of a nuclear attack. And then after that, it's Seattle. And of course, where we live, we have not been getting a lot of messaging about what to do in case of a nuclear attack. So we didn't know to do things like Hawaiians need to do, like to sit in your bathtub and fill it with water, I understand some people were doing, or thinking about, you know, where to go if you're out in public, if you are at work, if you're at home, what's the safest room in the building? So we were kind of at a loss. You know, we could have gone back to our vacation house, but it was built of wood and high on a hill and didn't really seem like, kind of seemed like the opposite of a concrete underground bunker. So it really made me realize that we all, hopefully government will take this more seriously, because it does seem like it could possibly happen. And if not government, then we will take it upon ourselves to educate ourselves about the safest place to be and safest way to protect our families in the event of a nuclear attack. And also, I mean, reading the analyses of how likely events are like this, like a little mistaken alert that goes out could actually set off a chain of events that result in a nuclear attack, is pretty chilling and makes you realize just how close to the brink we might actually be right now. So I think that there are a lot of cautionary tales here, and people should pay heed.
Well, Ann Dornfell, I hope you're going to be a different person now. I hope you're always going to remember to stop and give your coworkers little gifts and compliments and, you know.
I'll shape up, Bill.
I'm glad you're still okay in Oahu and enjoying it, and that you're going to come back safely. Ann, thanks for telling us the story.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Now, listening to all of that, you might be drinking $40 Pappy Van Winkle whiskey yourself and wondering whether this false alert could happen here in Washington State. Well, this morning I spoke to the Emergency Management Division of Washington and found out that this specific kind of mistake is not likely, because we don't have a pre-written incoming ballistic missile message ready to push to your phone. For that message to make it to you, somebody would have to type it in themselves. But Ann Dornfeld raises a good question there. What are the odds that human error, like the one in Hawaii, could lead us to something far worse, maybe to an accidental nuclear war? Well, the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser wrote a book about this kind of thing. It's called Command and Control: Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Eric, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
So your book has an ominous title, but you say this false alarm in Hawaii actually wasn't that dangerous. What do you mean?
It wasn't dangerous in the sense that the odds of it causing a nuclear war were almost zero. This was a technical malfunction and a mistake in a civilian early warning system. The much more dangerous glitches have occurred with our military early warning systems. That's when the president might be under enormous pressure to respond with nuclear weapons. And the danger is that we might launch our missiles based on a false alarm. And we've come close a few times.
Okay, about that military-civilian separation, before we leave that, you know, a lot of people have had this feeling that, well, even a civilian mistake, maybe a world leader watches television a lot, or for whatever weird reason people get their information and have their reactions, that even a civilian error could lead to a button being pushed. Somebody have a button on their desk that gets pushed.
Well, I don't think there's a button on the desk,
okay.
And it's possible that North Korea could see this warning and think that we're going to retaliate and decide to launch. But I think that's a series of steps that are unlikely. Mm. Unfortunately, what's more likely is what's already happened. At NORAD in 1979, someone inadvertently put a training tape that had a very realistic depiction of an all-out Soviet attack on the United States into a computer in our early warning system. And so the screens suddenly were filled with a very realistic account of how missiles were coming to the United States. That's the kind of thing that could lead to an accidental nuclear war. A year later, Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, was woken up in the middle of the night and told that 220 Soviet missiles were approaching the United States. He told his military advisor to check on that and call back. His military advisor called back and said, "Sir, it's actually 2,200 missiles approaching the United States." Brzezinski did not wake up his wife because he felt that Washington, D.C. was about to be destroyed. He wanted her to die in her sleep. And he began to prepare his retaliatory advice for President Carter about how many missiles we should launch when the phone rang again and he was told it was a false alarm. In that case, a 12-cent computer chip had failed and started generating these imaginary missiles. Now, William J. Perry, who was Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, was also woken up in the middle of the night during this false alarm, and it had a very lasting impact on him. It was a very upsetting experience, and it convinced him that accidental nuclear war is a low probability event, but not an impossible one, and we've got to really look at these systems carefully.
So the first instance, you mentioned someone leaving a training tape in a computer, and the next was a 12-cent computer chip. So do you worry more about technical failure or human error?
Well, you know, there's this tendency to blame human error. There's this tendency to blame the operator in Hawaii who clicked on the wrong choice in the drop-down menu. The human error I'm worried about is built into the systems themselves. One of the main themes of my book is that people are very good at creating complex technological systems. We're not so good at controlling them, and we're not good at all at knowing what to do about them when something goes wrong. So the problem lies in the system itself. People are fallible, and it's hard to imagine any machine or any network of machines that's going to operate perfectly. So when it comes to nuclear weapons, the margin of error is very small. I mean, in my book, I write about someone dropping a tool at a missile site and damaging a missile with the most powerful nuclear warhead we ever built on top of it. Now, you can blame the guy who dropped the tool, or you can say there's something wrong with a weapon system if being hit by a tool could detonate a nuclear warhead 600 times more powerful than the one that destroyed Hiroshima. And I hate to say this to you, but this is not a subject of theoretical or academic interest in Washington, because Seattle probably is the number one target in the continental United States.
Really? We heard that a few months ago, and then we heard that North Korea kept extending its capabilities, and so that it was able to launch a missile farther than Seattle, and that there was less danger because why would it be here if it could be elsewhere?
Well, I mean, if this were the 1950s, the top targets would probably be Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York City. But in the 21st century, Seattle happens to have the Strategic Weapons Facility Pacific at Kitsap Naval Base, which is the largest storage facility for active nuclear weapons in the United States. And it also has, in many ways, with Silicon Valley, the heart of our economy in a way that Chicago might have been 30, 40 years ago. So I don't want to get people there paranoid. I've spent more than a decade on this subject. I'm not apocalyptic. I don't think we're all doomed. But I do think this is the greatest threat that we now face, either deliberate or accidental nuclear detonations. And if anything, maybe something good can come out of this Hawaii false alarm, which will be there'll be much more attention paid to it and much more attention paid to the question of why are there 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world and what purpose are they really serving?
We're talking with Eric Schlosser, the investigative journalist and author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. And he obviously has a lot of stories to tell. The reason we're speaking of this is the false alarm in Hawaii. But Eric, what does it tell you that we've had no accidental nuclear war in 75 years? That doesn't make you feel any better?
Well, you could say on the one hand it's impossible. Or you could say it's a low probability event, and the longer you go without having it happen, the odds are it will happen. You know, for my book, I interviewed some of the leading nuclear weapons designers in the United States. I interviewed top generals from the Strategic Air Command, which during the Cold War were responsible for our nuclear weapons. I interviewed bomber pilots, missile launch officers, and again I heard the same thing, a feeling of amazement that no city has been destroyed by a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki in 1945. Now, you can say that's impossible, or you can say there's been a certain amount of luck involved and technical skill. I give great credit in my book to the safety mechanisms that our designers have come up with. But, you know, eventually, if we don't do something, a city somewhere is going to be destroyed. And I guarantee you when that happens, you will get the greatest, most powerful anti-nuclear movement ever. But I'd like to see that movement happen without a city somewhere in the world vanishing in a mushroom cloud.
Well, what should we want our government to do about it?
Well, the two countries in the world that have more than 90% of the nuclear weapons are the United States and Russia. And despite all of our differences and ideological problems, this is an area in which it's in our mutual self-interest to begin negotiations, to have constant dialogues. I mean, one of the great risks today is that there's an enormous pressure to launch your missiles if you think you're under attack, because if you don't launch them, you may never be able to use them. And there's some indications that we have a launch on warning capability. That is, once you get the warning, we get ready to launch our missiles. So there are all kinds of steps that can be taken between the United States and Russia to minimize that kind of risk and take missiles off of hair trigger alert and have all kinds of communication during a crisis so that we make sure, you know, we're not destroying one another and destroying much of the world because of a computer glitch or someone hacking into the system.
We talk a lot about President Trump's judgment. How much does it matter who is the president?
You know, it matters enormously. And I've said this before, but if Donald Trump were in the Air Force, he would not be allowed near nuclear weapons. There's a personnel reliability program that looks at your emotional stability, that looks at your personal honesty, that looks if you have any financial problems in your background. He literally would not be allowed to work with nuclear weapons. So it's of enormous concern. But I hate to say this, you could have the most stable, rational, wise president of the United States imaginable, and there'd still be a great risk because, as I said, the flaws are within the system. And if we get an alert, the president gets an alert saying that there are hundreds of missiles coming to the United States, he or she has anywhere from 5 minutes to 20 minutes to decide whether to retaliate. And I don't know very many people who, in that kind of pressure, could make the right decision with so many uncertainties. So again, Donald Trump, I think, is an enormous risk to the world, but the real danger lies in these complex technological systems. And I'm not a Luddite. I mean, I'm a techno geek in many ways, but we have to be very careful with complex systems that can have catastrophic effects when they go wrong.
You mentioned Seattle as a valuable target or a tempting target, perhaps. But we're working on a lot here in Seattle, including artificial intelligence. What are the odds that technology makes us safer, whether it's AI or redundancy programs, technology to the rescue?
Well, we can list 1,000 ways, 100,000 ways in which technology is making us healthier, is making us safer in so many ways. But when you're talking about nuclear weapons, the margin of error is remarkably small. You know, if a modern commercial airliner disappears over the Pacific, as one did a few years ago, it's a tragedy, and hundreds of lives are lost, and their families, you know, must grieve for them. But if something goes wrong with a single nuclear weapon, you're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of casualties. So I just don't have faith that there is ever going to be a perfect system. And artificial intelligence and machine learning are wonderful things, but they all begin with human beings creating code and software. I think that there's just always going to be a glitch hidden somewhere in the system. And when it comes to nuclear weapons, the risk of catastrophe will always be greater than zero. So yeah, I think we need to reduce that risk by improving our technological systems, but the real way to reduce that risk is greatly reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the world, greatly reduce the status of alert that they're on, and you know, get rid of the most dangerous machines ultimately that we've ever invented. I mean, nuclear weapons are the most dangerous machines. There's all this talk about killer robots and autonomous, you know, killing machines, but nuclear weapons beat them all in terms of their lethality.
Reduce or eliminate nuclear weapons, reduce the high safety high alerts, some of the advice from the author of Command and Control, the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser. Finally, I just want to know, because we heard my colleague, I don't know if you heard that, but she's in Hawaii on vacation, and she told us the story of what she did and mostly didn't know what to do in Hawaii when she got that text message. What would you have done in that situation? Your phone vibrates and it says, "This is not a drill, missile on the way." What would you have done?
I would have walked out to the beach, taken a look at the ocean, and enjoyed my final half hour on Earth, if that was going to come. I mean, during the Cold War, there were all kinds of civil defense programs, and, you know, a very famous hilarious film for children called Duck and Cover, that if you hid under your desk, you'd survive. And most of those programs were created not because there was a huge odds that you would survive a nuclear attack, but it was created to encourage people not to be afraid and to support our nuclear program. So I think if you're near a deep underground bunker, or you can go into a subway system, or there's someplace that's really going to be secure from a blast, by all means, go there. But if you're out in the open, enjoy the moment. That would be my advice.
Again, the book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Journalist Eric Schlosser is the author, and it's been really a pleasure, oddly a pleasure, talking with you about all of this, Eric. Thanks a lot.
Thanks again.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be talking about a piece of space debris that actually is hurtling toward Earth. We're not telling you that this is you should seek immediate shelter, but we'll tell you what you need to know in just a few minutes on KUOW. Stick around. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. 25 years ago, Maru Mora Villalpando came to the United States from Mexico City on a temporary visa. She never left. Maru built a career as a community organizer and social activist in Washington State. She had a daughter who's now a student at Western Washington University. A few weeks ago, Maru got a letter from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security calling her before an immigration judge. It's the first step toward being deported. Today, Maru and her lawyers held a news conference in downtown Seattle.
I see people being separated and being afraid. And I'm sick and tired of seeing that, and I don't want to be one of them, and that's why I started doing this work. Precisely because it's not fair to be treating people this way. And when I saw my daughter crying when she opened the letter, I got really enraged.
And now KUOW's immigration reporter Liz Jones is with us. She was at the news conference. Liz, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Bill.
Hi. Maru is, as we've said, a public figure. She's been in the press, local, national. She's organized protests in front of the Tacoma Detention Center. Why was it a surprise that ICE would target her?
Well, Maru called out two reasons specifically why she found this to be an unusual action taken by ICE against her. One is that she says she never has had any contact with ICE whatsoever, no contact with police or law enforcement that would have triggered her to be flagged for deportation. So that was one thing she found to be unusual. The second was this letter that was given to her, served on her from ICE. There's no date for a court hearing. They said the date will be set. She found that to be suspicious, too. Why wouldn't they just move forward with an action against her? She calls it an intimidation tactic on behalf of ICE. She says it's retaliation for her long-running and very public protests of ICE. So it's a surprise in a way that the timing is happening now, but it's something her family has planned for since day one. She's got a 21 or 20-year-old daughter. This has always been something that they've known could happen. They've had a ritual to check in with each other every time they're apart. They text each other, make plans with friends and neighbors. And her daughter has just said this has been the nightmare that she's expected.
Growing up with an undocumented mother, I had nightmares from a young age that one day my mother would be taken by ICE. On the day that I opened that certified letter from ICE that contained the NTA, I felt like that nightmare had come true.
Talking with our immigration reporter Liz Jones about this. And Liz, last week we found out that the Washington State Department of Licensing has been giving photos and addresses of undocumented residents to ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement agents. Do we know, is that how they got Maru's information?
We don't know that. Maru and her attorney suspect that may have been how they got her personal information. Maybe they got her address from the Department of Licensing. They're asking if that might have happened. They're asking for her file from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're asking for the Department of Licensing to provide them with more information. And they're also working with the University of Washington to file public records requests to find out the extent that the Washington Department of Licensing has cooperated with ICE in recent years.
Well, deporting somebody who's living here without documentation, that's not new. As you know, President Obama's administration deported 2.5 million people. What makes Maru and her lawyers think something different is going on now?
Well, something different with the Obama administration is they set up what was called the Priority Enforcement Program that gave guidance to agents out in the field about who to prioritize for arrests. one of the first things President Trump did was to eliminate those priorities, essentially making everyone fair game for immigration arrests. We have seen ICE target people with no criminal record, people who would not have otherwise been deported under President Obama. We've also seen ICE arrest other prominent advocates like Maru, other people who are out there advocating for immigrant rights. There were two immigrant rights leaders in New York who were recently arrested. There was a Dreamer who was arrested in March after giving a speech at a rally in Mississippi. So this has been something on people's radar of maybe ICE changing tactics and maybe something new afoot here.
And what is ICE? Again, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. What is ICE saying about this case?
I've asked ICE for a response specifically to Maru's case. I haven't got a response from them yet. But ICE, over the past year, has consistently said that they target serious criminals, people who pose a public safety threat. That is how they prioritize their enforcement efforts. And they have said specifically on the retaliation question, this came up recently with a Seattle Times reporting and an article there where ICE arrested somebody who had spoken in a Seattle Times article, and the ICE agents, the individual who was arrested, claimed that the agents told him he was being picked up because he had spoken to the press.
You were the one in the paper.
Right. And ICE denied that. They say they do not retaliate. So they've recently said they do not retaliate. That's not one of their tactics.
And finally, Liz, what happens to Maru now?
Well, lawyers are asking Immigration and Customs Enforcement to basically cancel her deportation notice, to say it was a mistake, to just call it off. She does have an option to apply for legal status. She's had no option to apply for legal status, I should mention, in the past 25 years she's been here. There was really no way for her to gain legal status. She does have one chance, though, with her daughter when she turns 21. Her daughter will be able to sponsor her to become a legal resident here in the U.S. Her daughter's 20 right now, so less than a year away. The next step will be they'll probably get a date from a judge to appear before an immigration judge. But what Maru is doing in the meantime is she's going to Washington, D.C. tomorrow to talk with her Congress members about how they can support her. She's going to meet with the U.N. Commission on Human Rights to see how they can support her. So she's not stopping. And she actually said, bring it on.
Liz Jones, KUOW's immigration reporter on our race and equity team. She will continue to cover the case of Maru Mora Villalpando. And you can follow Liz's work on KUOW.org. Liz, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. And now we have a story about the changing climate. You know, Seattle's got big plans to reduce climate change. To get there, electric cars are going to have to play a bigger part. Do we need to shame more people out of their gas guzzlers? Not exactly, as KUOW's David Hyde reports.
Naseeb Shama is an independent filmmaker who lives in North Ballard, and his car goes from 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds.
It's frightening.
Yeah. Oh! It pushes you back a little bit once you...
There's no engine noise in the Tesla Model S. It's like more of a hum.
The biggest thing was environmental. We got it because it's an electric car.
So why not take the bus?
I have three kids, and we live in North Seattle, North Ballard, and they go to school in the Central District. So yeah, we're in the car a lot.
Right now, only around 1% of cars in Seattle are electric. To meet its climate goals, the city needs to hit 30% by 2030. Brendan O'Donnell manages the electric vehicle program for Seattle City Light.
When you look at the carbon pie, you know, where the emissions come from, transportation is over 60%.
And O'Donnell sees big environmental benefits with electric compared to gas engines, because in Seattle, the power is mostly from hydro or wind and not from burning coal.
We're really blessed in that our carbon from our electricity sector is nothing. We have a carbon neutral electric utility.
Currently, there are still only a few thousand electric vehicles in the city. A lot of car buyers worry about going electric. Will I run out of juice? Where am I going to charge up? So, part of the City Light plan is to install 20 new fast charging stations this year that will charge most electric vehicles in under an hour. A number of private companies, including Volkswagen, are going to be rolling out new fast charging stations as well. And you don't have to spend $70,000 on a Tesla Model S. You could pick up a used Nissan Leaf for a couple $100 a month.
What if you could drive with zero emissions and you never had to stop for gas again, ever?
Okay, but how do you persuade people who are still reluctant to switch to an electric vehicle? Here's where the messaging on climate change gets kind of tricky. In Seattle, it's often implied that good people, if they drive at all, take hybrids or electric cars. And bad people?
I think we have to be careful about castigating people who purchase conventional material goods.
Like pickup trucks. USC professor Elizabeth Currid-Halkett says that's because of something people seldom talk about in Seattle, social class. And she says these days, class is not just about conspicuous consumption.
To care about the environment is a luxury. Okay, so it is omnipresent in our society, but it's very much an upper middle class value because you have the luxury to think about things other than rent, if you're going to keep your job, if you can pay your bills, and so forth.
But O'Donnell with Seattle City Light has an answer for that. He expects electric cars will be more widely used in lower income neighborhoods, not due to guilt or shame, but because electric cars are the best option, especially for the pros like cab or Uber drivers. That's the case right now with hybrid vehicles like the Toyota Prius.
It's not just Tesla. Tesla's great because it's a wonderful vehicle and people see them as an innovative technology. But what the city really wants to encourage is electric vehicles across different kinds of uses.
But will these changes come fast enough for Seattle to meet its climate goals? To stay on track, the city needs to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from the transportation sector 15 times faster than it's currently doing. Back in North Ballard, Naseeb Shahm is doing his part, and he's having a pretty good time with this Tesla Model S.
In the newer models, there's an option called ludicrous speed.
What does that mean?
I guess there's another gear, theoretically, that it goes faster than this car.
Let's not do that.
No, I'm good. I'm good.
In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
I kind of wanted them to go ludicrous speed. Well, on Thursday, you're going to hear how Seattle uses parking to deal with climate change. All this is part of our series, The Burning Question. What would a climate-friendly Seattle actually look like? It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to talk about fast bursts, mysterious radio bursts from space, and falling space debris, and all things.
Who knows? Asteroids?
Asteroids.
About a nuclear blast.
Yeah.
And, you know, just keep it going.
Let's talk about the big mysteries, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. I'm in Seattle, Washington, 3 billion light years away in outer space. There's some mystery object or something sending signals that scientists on Earth have detected. Radio waves blasting out from this unknown source. Are aliens messaging us? Or is there another explanation? Reporter Alan Boyle covers space science for the tech news site GeekWire. Great to see you, Alan.
Great to see you. Yeah.
First of all, how common is that for scientists to pick up radio waves from space?
Well, it's actually pretty common, but this is a special case. They call it FRB 121102, discovered in 2012. And the special thing about this one is that it has been doing this repeatedly. And so, spoiler alert, it's probably not aliens, but people are trying to figure out, you know, what is this source? It has to be a pretty energetic source.
Well, if in terms even I can understand, what do you mean, FRB? What's happening?
FRB, it just means that there's a source. It's some sort of star or something that is sending out blasts of radio waves that are being picked up by radio telescopes. And it can come maybe 15 blasts at a time, and then you wait a while, maybe a few months, and then it does it again. And so that's the mystery. There's only one source that scientists have found that does this sort of behavior. And so they're trying to figure out what is it that's special about this thing. And for a while, there were scientists who were saying, well, maybe it's some alien civilization that is using this bursting behavior to propel light sails across the galaxy, you know, like in Star Wars.
I like that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty
cool. What happened to that theory?
Well, it's very, very unlikely. It's more likely that it has something to do with powerful magnetic fields and neutron stars. They're very dense stars. If they're spinning, they can whip up a very strong magnetic field, kind of like a particle accelerator, hundreds or thousands of times more powerful than whatever we can do on Earth. And so the news about this source is that they analyzed some of these fast bursts from late 2016 and found that there were magnetic twists to the photons that were sent out by these bursts. And so they're saying, well, there must be something with a really strong magnetic field doing that. And that helps them kind of narrow in on this hypothesis that it's a neutron star. And maybe not just any neutron star, but a neutron star that's interacting with a black hole that's nearby. And so
neutron stars and black holes usually interact with each other?
Well, we haven't really seen firm evidence of that yet. That's something that the LIGO Observatory that looks for gravitational waves is definitely looking for. And there are some scientists who are saying that this meshes with what they expect the behavior to be. In fact, I was talking with one researcher, Jan Levin from Barnard College, who recently did a documentary on black holes called Black Hole Apocalypse. And this is exactly what she studies, is the whole idea that you can have a black hole battery, something that interacts with a magnetic neutron star and builds up just a huge amount of power and then releases it every once in a while when the battery gets overloaded. And so that's a good hypothesis for what's going on here. They don't know for sure what it is, but I have a feeling that as LIGO gets on the case and as they study this fast radio burst source more and more, they'll probably be zeroing in on that weird behavior, you know, something else for the menagerie of weird things in the cosmos.
I'm leaning toward the black hole battery thing myself.
Not aliens? I'm amazed.
Well, this is what I want to know, Alan, because I'm not a space science reporter, much less a scientist. Why should any of this matter to me except the not aliens part? That part I get. But why does this matter?
That is a question you often come across. And on one level, it's, it's the wonder of this, just understanding how nature works. I suppose if you were trying to get a government grant to do this, you might try to wave your hands and say something about how, well, maybe we could harness an energy source like this, or maybe there's some way we can create a mini black hole battery.
Work clean really, energy all, jobs in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Jobs.
STEM. Say something about STEM education. That doesn't
but matter. Really, it's all about the wonder and just understanding the strong physical forces that are at work in the cosmos that surrounds us.
Well, that's cool, which I still want to know, based on your years of space science reporting, do you think extraterrestrials are trying to contact us or fly in our airspace in disks, flashing lights?
Flying airspace in disk idea.
I always thought it was nice of the aliens to use flashing lights, like our airplanes do, so we won't run into flying saucers.
Right.
Well, I'm sorry. What do you think?
The distances are so vast that I think it's very unlikely that anyone, driving a flying saucer is going to get here anytime soon.
Okay.
But I do think that that would be kind of a natural impulse for people to seek out other civilizations, just like on Star Trek.
Okay, you're a flying saucer skeptic. What about the pulses? What do you think the odds are that it? Because we look for it, right? Actual scientists listen for these communications. Do you think there are any coming, or are you a skeptic about that?
I am a skeptic. It's going to have to be pretty firm evidence to convince me. I don't think it's these fast radio bursts. I think we're going to have to look for something else. And in fact, there are lots of discussions about what are the signs that civilization gives off. Just in the past few days, there was a new study saying, hey, maybe we should look for signs of global warming. If a planet suddenly grows hotter, maybe that indicates that they're generating more energy and facing the same problems that we're going to face in the decades ahead.
Uh-huh.
So look for bad behavior by the aliens.
But doesn't it seem like we keep looking for stuff that, of course, we would recognize?
That's the whole point, is that the search for other civilizations reflect affects the state of our own civilization.
Yes. Let's talk about the space objects that we don't want to see.
Right.
Why is a Chinese space lab hurtling uncontrolled toward Earth?
Well, first of all, everything that goes up must come down if it's in Earth orbit. Its orbit has to be boosted periodically. That's what happens with the International Space Station, is that they give it a boost every once in a while. Because even if you're traveling hundreds of miles above the Earth, there's enough atmospheric drag to pull stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the case of this Chinese space lab called Tiangong, the drag has been working on this, and the plan was for it to make a controlled descent into the Pacific, as was the case with the Mir space station. But in March 2016, they kind of lost control of it. It's not clear how much control the Chinese have. The Chinese say that they can bring it down in a controlled manner and take it down over the Pacific.
How do you do that if it's
Do the thrusters to push it down at a given time. Now,
Got working thrusters on it.
It's got working thrusters, but there's a lot of maybes involved here because the Chinese aren't very forthcoming about just how much control they have over it. They say they have control. There's a group called the Interagency Debris Coordination Committee, believe it or not, that is in
charge of
these sorts of things. Yeah, and they say that they have to assume that it's going to be uncontrolled. And so they're watching it very closely. And they have laid out what the plan is going to be. They say they won't know exactly where it's going to come down until a day before. But because of the object's orbit, I'm glad to tell you that Seattle is safe, that we don't have to worry about it personally in Seattle.
How do you know that let's say it is completely uncontrolled, unlike what the Chinese are saying? Why would you know that an uncontrolled 19,000-pound thing is not coming to Seattle?
Right. It's because of basic physics, orbital mechanics, that this object goes in an orbit at a specific inclination that never passes over Seattle. Seattle is at latitude 47 degrees, and this object never gets any higher up in latitude than 43 degrees.
Okay. I also love non-Seattleites. So what about other places where there are people?
Well, Portland is okay. Eugene is okay. San Francisco might have to worry a little bit. So,
really, but how much should anybody worry? How much should San Francisco or anyone else
not
worry?
A whole lot. It shouldn't be anything that keeps you up late at night, because it's something like a million times less likely than being struck by lightning than anyone would be struck by debris. And when we talk about even a 60-ton object that would be coming down, it's not going to be one big 60-ton object by the time it gets to the surface. A lot of it is going to burn up in the atmosphere. That's what happens with
most of
the space debris.
Yeah.
There might be some parts that do survive just based on past instances of this sort of thing. And so the one thing that you don't want to do is, if you see some sort of space debris coming down in your neighborhood, tell the authorities, but definitely don't go poking around in it, because it might be contaminated with hydrazine propellant. It's very nasty. So
you see something that might be space debris or a car fender.
Yeah, from space. Elon Musk's car, for example.
Don't touch it. Tell the authorities.
Exactly.
Okay.
News
you can use. So we're going to have one day of notice, and probably it's going to be fine.
Right.
But what would you do if you found out that, I know it's, you said not Seattle, but I'm just wondering, hey, you have one day and probably it's not going to land on your head, but who knows? What do you do?
I would say don't worry about it. It's not that big of a deal.
All right.
But, and it's going to come down sometime between mid-March and mid-April. So whatever you do, you got some time to plan.
Okay. Which reminds me, we were just talking about what would you do if you got the Hawaii text about the false missile alert. What would you have done?
My guest was saying, go
to the beach and enjoy the view.
I definitely wouldn't just go out to the beach and wait for the world to end. I would try to take shelter because, if it's a direct blast, you're done for sure. But it's probably not going to be a direct blast. And so you want to protect yourself from the fallout or all those things that people talked about during the Cold War of duck and cover and, find shelter.
Let's say you're in Hawaii, Alan Boyle, and you hear
the U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii.
And you do what?
Well, I would try to find the best shelter that I could. For example, I was at a hotel in Hawaii a day before this happened, so I would try to seek out the hotel managers and find out where their best shelter for this sort of thing would be and go there, and definitely not head out to the beach.
You wouldn't use your contacts to get launched into space, because if you're up in space, you're probably safer than anyone. And you could probably pull it off.
That sounds like a movie.
You're Alan Boyle.
Movie, yeah.
Alan Boyle, space science reporter. He knows a lot of stuff about this, and he reports for the tech news site GeekWire, and we just love to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
It's it for The Record today, a show put together by Amin Al-Saadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Join us on Twitter at KUOW.